Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. As we approach the fourth anniversary of the May 14th Tops mass shooting, we begin today with a panel discussion following a screening of 514, The Journey Here, The Hope to Come. Joining the conversation are community activist Garnell Woodfield, Buffalo State University Associate Professor of Philosophy and Africana Studies, John Torrey, and financial advisor Mark King. The discussion is moderated by BTPM's own Sufana Wajid. The conversation focuses on Black history, economic inequities, community trust, and the future of Buffalo's East Side.
As we observe Black history, it's always a time to reflect on what we've made changes for. Also, how we've brought forth inventions so that humanity could get into a posture of thriving, right? And we always have to say that we create history every moment we're breathing. Like, we're creating history right now, right? And we want to continue to do that as we go along. I grew up in Buffalo in the 70s and 80s. I know somebody's probably gasping like, oh, really? But yes, I'm that old or that young, however you want to look at it. But I can remember Jefferson being a vibrant and viable business hub. You know, you had the cleaners, you had, yes, you had all these different restaurants. You had the beauty supply store that was owned by the Gales. Just variety of small businesses that you could get whatever you needed to get and rely upon everybody in that area. So I know that I think sometimes we look at that past and feel like, well, will we ever get back to that? That's possible. I think it's possible when we talk about hope, you know. But I know that after decades, after the 70s and 80s, things started to fall into despair. There was a lot of dismay, I know. And leading up to 514, and now after 514, as Annetta said, things are still looking the same. And in some cases, I feel like it looks worse. So with Buffalo receiving millions and millions of dollars after the massacre, as mentioned in the documentary, there's still several inequities that the East Side faces, as the infrastructure of old homes, building facades, streets, and the fact there's still only one grocery store over there and a very small variety of small businesses. I know we also heard in the film how we are. Historically, we have always relied upon each other to provide items and services like a cup of sugar, a babysitter up the street, a midwife, a handyman. If it were a common need, there was a neighborhood or neighborhood-wide, we would communicate by meeting at each other's houses or even passing in the street. So, Garnell, I want to pose this question to you. do we continue to communicate with our neighbors to discuss what the issues are and create our own solutions and action plans for what we may be able to manage on our own, or do we pivot and do something different?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. I don't think there's, you know, one answer for that. Mm-hmm. I think we have to do all of those things. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, much of what has happened generationally within our community has caused those relationships to break down, has caused us not to trust one another, has caused us to compete with each other. And I think that, you know, we talk about building buildings, we talk about infrastructure and all of these things. I think that, you know, in my estimation, I think the people are broken. I think that the investment has to be in the people to help build trust, to build hope, to build those relationships. And from that, foundationally, you can start to climb out of this hole. So I think we have to do all of those things. Okay. I don't think we have to certainly have an agenda. We have to control the narrative. Mm-hmm. We have to tell our own story. We have to do all of those things. But we also can't do that in a silo.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask Dr. Torrey, in your research, what have you came across as ways in which we have unified and gained equity?
You mean the ones that survived or the ones that we were able to, like, pull off for a moment?
Well...
We've been able to, who was that? That was Dr. Davis that had mentioned at the end that hope is resiliency. Mm-hmm. Throughout the Black American story, you're going to find consistent versions of gains and then backlash, gains and then backlash. Mm-hmm. And right now we're living through a version of backlash. Mm-hmm. So while we've been able to acquire equity, say, through legal changes, segregation was formally legal, now it's informally legal, not formally legal. Yeah. There are ways in which we were able to be treated and mistreated that were considered to be overwhelmingly appropriate. Now we call them injustice, and we can actually have people be arrested and prosecuted and receive criminal punishment for mistreating us and taking advantage of their positions of power and denigrating us at the same time. So what I found, at least in my research, is we have examples of Black people being able to stand up on their own too. As many times as we've seen Black communities, we've seen examples of Black people being able to stand up on their own too. That's just as many examples that we've had where there's been a backlash for the ability to stand up independently, in particular for something like for Tulsa, for example, mm-hmm. or the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. You're finding institutions of communities and relationships that are able to survive and thrive provided they're not interfered with. Mm-hmm. And the backlash is usually rampant, wanton, and violent interference.
Thank you for that. Let's speak about health and wealth, and we know that it goes hand in hand. There's a medical term called weathering. It defines how social and economic disadvantages accelerate the decline of a physical health. My father always says, your health is your wealth. Now, that can be looked at in two different ways. One, if you are not healthy, then you do not have the motivation and energy to make the necessary moves to build wealth. And then two, if you do not have a level of wealth that affords you the ability to buy a car or take other means of transportation to get to the store to purchase healthy foods and keep a roof over your head, then that affects your mental health. You're always worried and stressed about the lack of money. Mr. King, with funding for programs and financial assistance and resources being cut or slowly coming in, how can people continue to improve their finances?
Access to resources is one of the most difficult challenges we have in our community. When I say that, what we also have is this huge void of education and knowledge. And with that void in education, with lack of education, comes a kind of a mysterious kind of reality that says that, okay, does everybody really understand the journey that Black folk have gone through since slavery? I've been giving presentations on the wealth gap from slavery to present day. And we are still in a position right now where we're fighting for equal treatment, equal access. And the most important thing that we have to recognize is that resources are going to become less and less as we go forward. They're being taken away from us. We're being kind of diminished. And so where we have to start is that we have to recognize that we have communities that are just in so much despair and pain that the question is, where do we start? How do we really build wealth? And the issue about wealth comes to a head when we start using language that is above and beyond a certain group of people. So when I use the word wealth, that means different things to different socioeconomic groups of people. But when I use different types of language, like who do you owe what to, how much do you owe, where do you go to get some type of financial relief, how can I put meals on the table, how do I even balance my checkbook, that language isn't pervasive throughout our entire community. So it's important for us to recognize that when we use words like wealth and prosperity, we eliminate huge segments of our population. People are living day to day. And what we have to do is break down that language so that we invite people into just understanding that there are resources out there for them that they could actually reach out and gain some footing so that they can just get to a position where they can understand that I can go here or I can go there. We have to just understand that we are in such despair and people have lost so much dignity that we've got to start trying to rebuild people and making feeling better about themselves and where they can go.
Anyone else want to say anything about that?
Well, I just agree with what he said. Again, okay. To reiterate, it's about rebuilding people. Mm-hmm. People have to be the priority. You know, that it starts with the people. And so I appreciate what Mr. King said.
It strikes me that infrastructure, community is itself an infrastructure that has to get built up. So we tend to think of infrastructure as roads, buildings, houses, public goods and services.
That's a good point, yeah.
We are the infrastructure that that builds up the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so if we're broken or we're destitute or we're in need, then our ability to create community is the ability to create an infrastructure upon which we can build for the better future we're trying to get.
And where do you think, you know, as individuals, they should start? Should they start with going to a therapist, or should they start with their primary? Like, I know it goes hand in hand, like your mental and your physical goes hand in hand, but, you know, what if somebody out there listening to this conversation is like, I don't even know where to start?
I think it's important for us to recognize that we have some challenges that are just not being talked about or being discussed. And so what happens is that when you take a community and you have a large population that's impoverished and you have people living day to day, what happens is that these people become stigmatized and they go underground. And they go underground because their credit rating is so low, they have no access to resources and capital. And what happens is that they don't want to surface for any reason, because they either owe someone or owe somebody. So what we have to start doing is we have to start making sure that people feel safe about surfacing. And the important thing is that, you know, who's to blame why somebody is underwater financially? Who's to blame that somebody's paying credit card interest rates at 20%? Who's to blame that someone can't get a car loan and they're paying 10%+ just to get a car? Forget the blame for a second. We need people to feel safe and to start surfacing with some of these challenges that they have and giving them solutions on how to kind of just get through. The system is not going to forgive anybody. If you owe somebody some money, the system is not going to let you surface. So we got to recognize that people are trying to avoid institutions and systems simply because of their situation. And so we're going to have to give them safe havens to surface so that we can start to understand what they need in order to kind of just come back to a level where they can start talking about issues about wealth.
Thank you. So even if we identify the issues, solutions, and put action plans in place, we're still faced with the policies and the practices that perpetuate inequity. I want each of you to answer this. How do you continue to challenge and dismantle structural racism?
Well, Well, I mean, I think you've got to be willing to speak up and stand up. I mean, I think it all starts with you being committed to change, committed to that in such a way that, you know, we have people in leadership positions or people with authority or people who have influence or whatever. But if you're not willing to put your title, your comfortability, whatever it is, on at risk for the things that you say you believe in, for the things that you aspire to, then you probably should not be in that position, because that's what it requires. It requires all of us to be willing to sacrifice whatever comfortability, whatever false sense of security we have for that thing that we believe in, that we aspire to. And so I think that it starts with that. And that's a personal choice. But as people within the community, we should require that of our leaders. We should hold them accountable. We have to hold them accountable. I think it starts with speaking up. We talked about controlling the narrative and telling our story. And we have to be able to do that. We have to do it as intentionally as those who have subjugated us or kept us down.
Okay. Dr. Torrey?
We need to have a willingness to confront our ignorance. For many of us, a lot of the everyday experience of the average Black person is something we don't fathom well enough unless we are already in it and we can't see anything other than it. Which means we have a lot of assumptions about how the world's working, about what fairness looks like, about who's getting what and who's supposed to get what. And a lot of that is born out of rampant ignorance that is supported by misinformation campaigns. It's supported by the ongoing backlash against Black success and Black excellence. It's supported by the centuries of narrative building about how Black people aren't this, aren't that, can't be this, and won't be that. As a result, a lot of us, myself included, I'll admit, we've all got ignorance that we need to be willing to confront, because institutions are made up of individuals. There are individuals who carry on the cultures of those institutions. You also get a chance to change those cultures if you choose to confront the ignorance that we've all got. And it sounds harsh to say it, like, oh, I'm not that ignorant. None of us are that ignorant, but we're ignorant enough that we have something that we need to confront to be able to be on the better side. If we want to be on the right side of history, we can't think we're on the right side of it now.
There's today, as we sit here, there's a huge swath of our population where we're battling implicit and explicit bias. This is something that we've had research. The numbers are just staggering if you look at them. And this is bias toward people of color. That's what we're dealing with today. Not from slavery, not from Jim Crow, but today. With that existence comes a lot of inequities in terms of how we're treated or how we fare. Now, one of the things that we have to recognize is that awareness, education, and this word ignorance is so important. We have to make sure that we put a full court press on education. Education is absolutely critical to our survival as a people. The family unit is a critical aspect of something we have to start rebuilding. We will not survive as a race unless we understand the importance of family. So that brings back some of the things we have to go back to basics on: spirituality, family, and education. And education becomes so critical because it's something we can do now. It's something we can work on now. And if we're having trouble as adults, let's see what we can do today about making sure that our kids are properly educated and aware of these pitfalls of explicit and implicit bias.
Thank you. I would also like to add, we go back to how our elders took care of themselves health-wise. You know, yes, doctors are great. I will not, you know, say that they're not. But we also have to go back to how did we take care of ourselves, mind, body, and spirit? How did they do that back then? Because that all goes together along with education and all of that. Oftentimes have attended panel discussions, and we have spirited discussions and we have great dialogue, and sometimes we don't always have people give solutions and have action items to take away with them. And it doesn't have to be a heavy lift. So I would say ask each one of you to give an action item for those who are in the audience to take back to their communities that could be impactful. And it doesn't have to be anything heavy, a heavy lift, but just somewhere to start.
I mean, I'll start. I mean, I think just as we are sharing this space and this time and this, in this room, I think that this is where change begins. This is how change begins. It's a personal thing. It starts with, you know, talking to each other, seeing each other, hearing each other, you know. And I think oftentimes we look for these sea changes, these big changes, you know. We want something to happen because there's so much wrong in the world, you know, so much wrong within our lives. We want it all changed, but we didn't get here overnight. This has been generations for generations. We have endured these things and find ourselves in this space. And I think that we have to be willing to commit to taking, you know, whatever step we can in our own individual lives, around our dinner tables, within our, you know, circle of friends and community, and have these very difficult discussions about, you know, what's really going on, you know, how we got here. And I think when we do that, we see each other as human beings. We see our humanity. We see our, you know, see ourselves in each other, and that allows us to have these conversations and it allows us to deal with these very difficult issues. So I think you know, we talked about hope. You know, we are the hope. We are the change that we see. You know, it is us. It's not something outside of us, some nefarious thing. It's not, you know, the $150 million we talked about, all the money that's flowed into the East Side. It's each one of us taking responsibility for wherever we are. You know, after 514, before 514, I was not an activist. I was not out here working. I was empathetic. You know, I cared about people. I prayed. I went to, you know, see about people and did all kinds of things, donated money or whatever. But I really wasn't out here working against gun violence, against hate, against these things that we're talking about now, you know. And so when that happened on 514, I had to accept responsibility. In my silence, I'm complicit. In my silence, I'm complicit. And that's a hard thing for me to say. But I acknowledge that. And so I have committed and dedicated myself to speaking up and to being a part of the solution. And I think that's, you know, and I hope that doesn't happen, you know, things like this doesn't have to happen to other people for them to do that, for you to understand that in your silence, you know, as good a person as you may be, you are complicit and you are part of the problem. There's many more good people in the world than bad, but the bad people speak up and the good people don't.
You still thinking, Mark? I'm okay. I suppose I'm supposed to give you all homework now. So there would be two things I would think of. On the first hand, it's double down on your own education. So Black History is 365, not 28 days. In fact, if you go to the UK, they do it in October. They get 31 days there. So it's a full year approach to understanding the Black experience, and not just here, but also globally. Take that as a responsibility. We're at the end of Black History Month. We got less than a week, basically. Use every day to learn something new about the Black experience, and then keep that same energy for the rest of the year. You may end up being surprised about what kind of respect and perspective you may have about what Blackness looks like, because we just haven't given ourselves the permission and the discipline with the time to continually invest in that kind of education about your neighbor, your friend, your partner, your business person, your coworker, your spouse, your community. On the other side to that, you better learn to get a sense of justice. You better learn to be brave. None of this happens without folks being willing to put some skin in the game, put their life on the line, see themselves as their neighbor and go, if it's bad for them, it's bad for me. You better get a sense of justice, a strong sense of justice. And that will carry you to be braver than you think you ever can be, where you'll step in for people who can't do, and where you'll step in and you'll be the brave one to say, this can't happen in my community. Like we've seen in, say, Minneapolis. That's a strong sense of justice. This can't happen in my community. So may we all develop that same kind of sense of justice and have it be historically and educationally informed so, again, we can build the right kind of world that we're supposed to have. That's your homework. You need to email me when you get it done.
There's a big question that I confront myself with on an ongoing basis. And the question is that what can I do? Just as an individual, what difference can I make? And I think it's important for everybody to kind of just ask themselves that question. Because what I've started to do over the last year is I've gone to the NAACP, we've gone through the Urban League, we've gone through Hispanic groups, we've gone through union groups, we've gone through DEI over at Citibank, and we've been making a presentation on the wealth gap. The education presentation is an hour, and it goes through the trillions of dollars that have either been taken or lost by the black population. Trillions. I'm not even talking one trillion. I'm talking at least $50 trillion. Now, if you don't understand that, you can't understand the lack of dignity and pride that a group might have because of the condition that they're in. What I challenge everybody to do is to take advantage, because we're going to circle the wagons again, and we're going to give this presentation. I think the presentation is important for all people to understand systemically what's happened to African Americans in this country over the decades. Because if you don't understand or know that, you won't understand our cry, our anguish, our pain. So we've developed that presentation, and it goes all the way from 1619 to the preamble to the Constitution, where only 3/5, all the way to the Homestead Act, all the way to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, all the way through Jim Crow, all the way through sharecropping, all the way through incarceration, and all the way through present day. If you don't understand that systemically and understand what we're seeing and hearing today, you don't get it. And I think in terms of wealth and wealth building, if you don't understand that we've done everything we possibly could have to build wealth, and it's been taken away time and time again, we're exhausted. I'm just asking everyone to just dig deep inside and ask themselves, what can I do?
Thank you. And Mark, where can they find out about the presentation?
We're going to be giving the presentation once again through the NAACP. We've reached out to the Urban League. We've reached out to the Michigan Street Group. So you're going to see it and you're going to hear it. We've made the presentation to most of the managers over at the City of Buffalo. It is an hour presentation that has changed my life, because I didn't know half of what I'm presenting right now, and I didn't even know that if you look at disparities for black and brown people across the board, there's not any category where we're not behind. And it's not because we're lazy, it's not because of any of that. Because if you look historically at what's happened, you'll understand that in spite of all those things, we are an incredibly gifted, promising people. And the one thing that we recognize is that we are proud Americans. You know, the blackness is something that makes us a little bit more special, but we're proud Americans. And I started even looking at inventors and the contribution we've made. And if you look to see the things we've invented that we've gotten credit for and that we haven't gotten credit for, you will be blown away. Because you had no idea of the contributions we've made to this country and how we were systematically marginalized in spite of all of it. We are miracles sitting here today. 2 million people died along the slave route. 2 million. 12 million survived. And if you look at what's happened over that period of time, we became sharecroppers because they took away the 40 acres and mule promise. And they locked us in the South. 93% of all black people in the South had to have a contract for sharecropping or a contract with another plantation, or else they were criminalized and put in jail. So I'm just saying that we're going to be given the presentation. And the presentation, I think every citizen in this country should see the presentation. And I think it's not to make excuses. It's just to recognize that we're just an incredible, and this word resilient, you have no idea what that means until you get a grasp of what this looks like.
Thank you. I also like, yes, clap, please. I also like to leave everyone with, find out what the need is in your circle, in your neighborhood, you know, and create the service. You know, maybe there are some elders that need a ride to the grocery store. Maybe there's somebody that needs a ride to, you know, their appointment or something like that. So to figure out what is the need and then create the service. When I was asked by Catherine, our director of programming, at first I was a little apprehensive because I'm usually the person sitting in the audience. but I thought this was a great opportunity for community to come together and hear what people had to say about where do we go from here. You know, we do a lot of talking, but let's start putting some action, you know, behind it.
Now we turn to Jay Moran and EJ Cecile as they preview part one of our 3-part special, centered on the biggest question still asked 4 years later. What happened to the money promised to Buffalo's East Side?
This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'm Jay Moran. Ejaz Jasil, our reporter here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, has been following Where Did the Money Go? We're looking at pledges of millions of dollars to the East Side community in the wake of the 514 massacre of May 14th, 2022, on the Jefferson Avenue Tops. It claimed 10 lives and traumatized an entire community. Ejaz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Jay. Appreciate this.
And I appreciate the work that you've been putting in on this, because this is a long way to go. Let's talk about, I said millions. Can you give me specifics of what we're talking about that we've been able to identify as quote unquote pledges to the community?
Yeah. So if you want it down to the penny, just what I've gotten based on press releases, news story, things that have happened from 514 to date, we're looking at $91,256,623.56. That's the amount of money that I could identify that people have given or pledged since 514. Now, this includes federal and state grants, corporate donations, private donations, all sources of funding, over $91.2 million devoted to Buffalo's East Side.
There are, like you said, there are government grants. There are also private foundation grants, private company grants. You said that you followed, you were able to identify these. How?
I did a deep dive just searching old articles, you know, old press releases, of folks who, you know, gave. There were a lot of stories at the time of, you know, this is everyone who's given following 514. And then I wanted to make sure I really verified that I wasn't just reporting secondhand information. So any, you know, whether it was a news article or a sort of release, I would track it all the way back to the source itself, to the government website or the corporate donor's annual report, whatever the case may have been, to verify, yes, this is exactly where this money came from. This is the amount they gave or that they said they gave. So a lot of cross verification, but really, honestly, just one by one.
Sure.
I literally just spent picking out all of these different entities and the dollar amounts.
So a couple of things I want to bring our listeners' attention to. First and foremost, especially in the wake of 514, I recall it very well, this kind of outpouring of supportive language to the East Side community and the people who were impacted by the 514 attacks, which I think all of us at the time were very grateful for it. It came from a lot of different parts. And then, of course, the pledging of funding. That's one thing I want to make sure that we get out there, and that the spirit was most certainly in the right place. That being stated, I want to also go over how dogged this process really is. I think one of the things that is one of the trends that have happened in our society is this sense that journalists just make things up or just find news out of the air. And that's not the case at all. You had to go through over 60 different donation sources, people who announced that they were going to be making some sort of contribution to community efforts, and then follows up to find out whether or not that money got to where it was. Let's just take one as an example of somebody who you started off, you found it on your list, and then you went through it. Just if you can, take us through a life in the day of Ejaz the reporter.
Yes, so life in the day of Ejaz in this context was reaching out to over 30 people a day via phone and email. That's one thing that's just my standard of reporting. I like to reach out to people through different avenues because some folks will say, oh, well, I'm more responsive by phone or I'm more responsive by email. So everyone, I made sure that I reached out to as many areas of contact as I could with them. One example that I'll give of someone I reached out to was West Her. I saw that they made a pledge of $300,000 following the tragedy. And so I reached out to them via phone and I heard back and, you know, they said, we'll get you that information. I think it was on a Friday. They said, we'll follow up with you on a Monday. And on Monday, they did send me via email the verification of the money that they gave and a breakdown of, you know, how those expenses were allotted. So some donors were really forthcoming. Delaware North is another one. They were very responsive, very willing to, you know, give me the information that I was seeking. Some organizations gave me a list of entities that their dollars went to. And, you know, I asked, well, can you break down the amount of money and how much funds did you give to each of these entities?
Sure.
Some did. Like, for example, a $100,000 General Mill grant that was distributed through the United Way. United Way did provide me a breakdown with how much money they gave to each organization. Some donors were not as forthcoming. You know, not to throw anyone under the bus, but just to be completely transparent here, because that is the point of this entire project, transparency. I reached out to the Key Bank Foundation. They pledged $250,000 plus a 2-to-1 employee match.
So employees were contributing as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they were. And they did give me a list of 11 different entities that they gave the money to. I said, oh, this is great. Thank you. Now, would you mind giving me a breakdown of how much money you gave to each of these different entities? And they declined to do that. So I don't know what the intention was there. That's not to accuse that they didn't give what they said they actually give. You know, I am not making any sort of assumptions here, but it's just been interesting going through this process, seeing what some folks were willing to share and what some weren't. And it just makes me dig a little deeper. You know, we're really trying to track down this money to the penny, down to those 56 cents, you know, not just accounting for the $91.2 million. So trying to find out, you know, where the money goes as far as possible. It's been a process.
Yeah, so we don't know why they wouldn't necessarily want to give those dollar amounts. Perhaps that's information that'll be forthcoming at another date. Mm-hmm. But like, just for example, we'll use West Terre since that's the first one you mentioned. And you know, the quick turnaround for them, you know, from a Friday to a Monday, that's pretty good. And especially in a large organization, which might be, you know, sometimes difficult to find out actually even who the people are in charge of that. But you said that they were able to give you like a breakdown of the organizations that they were donating money to?
Yes. So they explained to me that their contribution went to People Inc. for grief counseling for families and other folks who had been impacted. So, you know, they let me know that went towards supporting coupling folks from the community and impacted individuals with counselors who could, you know, assist them during that time.
Okay, so that's most certainly a fairly easily connected a string of money right there for sure. At the same time, I'm wondering if are we finding any donors who perhaps, okay, we're pledging money to support the victims during this trying time, and maybe these are organizations that are already committing to supporting organizations in the community, and perhaps maybe just through a little spin control, so to speak. I want to be careful how much I'm accusing. I don't want to sound like I'm accusing anybody, but just the idea that, oh yeah, well, you know, we're already spending thousands of dollars supporting this organization, and we're just putting it under the guise of 514. You finding anything like that?
I have run into that in a couple of instances. One that I will bring up is the Buffalo Bills Foundation. Okay. They released a sort of PR article through their site on May 14th, 2024. So it was under the guise of, you know, how the Bills are continuing to give back on the second anniversary of the 514 tragedy. And one of those items was a pledge of over $270,000 over 3 years to Cornell Institute's Buffalo Healthy Community Store initiative.
Okay.
So I emailed them just to ask, you know, I saw you got this pledge. Was there any more funding that you received in relation to 514? And I received a response from the coordinator. She said, I'm sorry, you're mistaken, that we didn't receive this money in relation to 514. We applied through the foundation's standard grant process, and this supported work that we'd already been doing since our inception. So I'm still waiting to hear back from the Bills, but it was framed in that article along with a couple of other entities that they gave to as we're doing this as a result of 514 to honor the community. But it seems to be something that they already had in place. And I've seen that pop up a couple of little places, and it's, for lack of a better term, gives me kind of an icky feeling because it's almost, I don't want to say capitalizing, but you're framing this within the context of something horrible that's happened for this community. And as you said earlier, it is a great thing, and these are great contributions.
The spirit is correct.
Yes, the spirit is correct. But to say, you know, we're doing this to honor what happened this day, but it's something you already had in the works, I think it's kind of misleading.
We are talking with Ejaz Jasil, my colleague here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Her series that she's been working on, we're going to be hearing more from coming up on our anniversary show of What's Next. Where did the money go? Looking at where funds pledged to Buffalo's East Side community in the aftermath of the 514 attacks in 2022. Where has that money gone? Where is it right now? I'll point one out that I'll cut my eye right off. It was a grant from the Department of Justice I got your spreadsheet in front of me, almost $144,000. And this ended up, it was supposed to reduce gun violence in the city of Buffalo, and ended up at Rochester Institute of Technology. You may not have been able to really find out anything more about that, but doesn't that highlight that kind of what we were just talking about, that there's money that's being utilized for hopefully good purposes? This most certainly sounds like a good purpose, but maybe it's being shaded to fall under this 514 umbrella, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an instance that definitely set off some bells for me, especially when we have a lot of gun violence reduction programs and organizations here in the city of Buffalo. Not taking anything from the work that the Rochester Institute of Technology does, but in response to the 514 tragedy and specifically to reduce gun violence in the city of Buffalo, I would think that money would go into the city of Buffalo, but it was invested in a, I guess, not even neighboring city. You know, right. It's Western New York, but it's not even, you know, it's Monroe County. So, sure. Yeah, there were even with the government's, you know, sense of giving, there was some of that where it's like, okay, we're allocating money in the name of 514, but we're throwing it all the way over here. And it's like, well, what's the intention really? What's the intention and who's it really for?
Right. So in one of those kind of confusing gray areas that unfortunately, you know, that may not come to light, at least in the waking hours that you have to continue to research the CJAS.
Yeah.
There are two major funds, it seems, right, that we're kind of a pledge to in this almost over $91 million. And I know you have the exact sense, so I'll let you put the decimal on it. But let's talk about that a little bit, what they've received, what we know about these organizations, and what we might expect moving forward.
Yes. So the two main funds that were really born out of this tragedy were the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund and the Buffalo Together Community Response Fund, which they've let me know is just now called Buffalo Together.
Okay. All right,
so the Buffalo 514 Survivors Fund was an endeavor through the National Compassion Fund, which this is a national nonprofit that handles cities, that has, you know, dealt with gun violence, mass shootings, helping the victims, the communities during this time. The fund was created with $500,000 in seed money given by Topps Family Markets. And ultimately, over $6.4 million was raised for that fund, and 100% of proceeds were to go to victims, families of victims, and survivors.
Specifically?
Yes.
$6.4 million. So families of victims, survivors.
Yes.
Okay. So there must be, what's the word I'm looking for, requirements, for lack of a better term, guidelines, protocols.
Yes.
For who would fall under those categories.
Yes. So there were, I believe, four different categories. The first was to be a family member of someone who was deceased. The second was someone who was physically hurt, whether they were shot, hit by shrapnel, something of that nature. And the third was someone who endured psychological damage. I apologize if I'm missing up the third and the fourth, but
sure.
There was a class for
the trauma of the event.
Yeah, like any
them.
Yeah, someone who witnessed it, whether inside the store or within like a certain amount of feet from the parking lot. And then there was also a level of compensation for employees of that Topps Market who were not there that day, but, you know, who still worked there.
Okay.
And yes, they came out, the National Compassion Fund came out with a map during this time, which literally had the area circled. You had to be within this vicinity to, you know, be compensated.
So very specific.
Yes, very specific. And they worked with the FBI, DA, local law enforcement to verify who was there that day.
Okay. So we know they had some fairly stringent requirements. At the same time, were there perhaps omissions from these beneficiaries that stood out to you?
I actually did find a couple of omissions. I met a wonderful woman who lives on the east side of Buffalo. Her name is Dolores Jackson. She was actually parked next to Peyton Gendron. She, of course, obviously did not know at the time who she was parking next to or what was about to happen, but her car wound up getting hit and damaged by gunfire. She was in the freezer while the shooting was going on inside the Tops. And, you know, despite being a witness and being in the store, she was told, and, you know, what she described the 11th hour, that she was not eligible for compensation. Same for a gentleman who lives on the east side named Grady Lewis. He witnessed the shooting from the parking lot. He also encountered the man who, you know, committed out the heinous act the day before and had a conversation with him. Of right. course, again, not knowing who he was. You know, both have had financial loss. They've had, you know, psychological damage, trauma that they're still trying to get over. And both of them tell me they still receive notices from the FBI about where, you know, when court appearances are going to happen. And so they're verified, by the FBI and by local law enforcement as having been there. But they were both told, I saw their letters, the rejection letters from the National Compassion Fund, that law enforcement could not verify that they were there. And so they were denied those funds.
I hope everybody who's listening today can appreciate what I'm appreciating is the level of competence that is going into this investigation by Ejaz Jasil on where did the money go. I know there's a lot more to get into, and obviously we're going to have a special program coming up on What's Next about this. But I'm also curious, as you were talking about Grady and Dolores, members of the community.
Yes.
Inside that circle.
Mm-hmm.
Around that store.
Yes.
Can you share with me, between the conversations that you had, whether it was with these sources about this money or just other conversations throughout your endeavors, well, what that community is still feeling 4 years later? It's going to be 4 years on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
What is the sense that you get from people in the community?
I think the thing that probably hit me hardest was that there is a general consensus of people who live in the community. And it's that it's not that things have gotten better or that things have remained the same since 514. Everyone says that things have gotten worse.
Worse.
And they say that for different reasons. Grady, for example, said it's worse because, you know, a lot of people, especially elderly people who live in the area, are not comfortable even coming outside anymore. A lot of people are dealing with trauma, with, you know, just the psychological damage. Like he said, you know, something he contends with, even if he doesn't want to think about it, the first thing he sees when he steps out on his front porch is that Tops Market. Couldn't avoid it if he tried.
Mm.
And a lot of, I'm finding, you know, a lot of people that I've spoken to have said, any mental health counseling I've gotten, it's been, you know, through my own resources. There are millions of dollars in government funding, and even some corporate donors gave to counseling, grief counseling, mental health resources. But people say, I've been to the centers where they say they were supposed to provide these services, and no one said they were able to help me. So there's been some of that. I spoke with Mark Talley, who, you know, is the mother of one of the 10 victims, Geraldine Talley, and he told me he feels like it's gotten worse over there because a lot of people used 514 almost to self-promote, whether right. it was to gain money or to gain recognition of some sort for whatever endeavor that they had going on. It's like people, ever since the tragedy, they'll show up. It'll be a big hurrah on Jefferson Avenue, 514. By 515, everything and everyone's gone. See you next year. So, you know, as he described it and as a lot of people describe it, there has been no substantial investment. A lot of people say you can literally see it. You can look and you can still see all the empty lot and all the homes that have not been fixed up and the fact that there are still no new grocery stores, you know. So that's been a heartbreaking part of it, to hear, you know, that things have gotten worse and that there seems to be a lot of people who have gained in some way or another off of this tragedy, and those people are not of the community.
We're winding down to our final couple of moments here with Ejaz Jasil, previewing Where Did the Money Go? You only gave us a little bit of the tip of the iceberg here.
A little bit of a lot.
A lot. And you also have more to do. I mean, you're not totally completed with this. Just talk about your goals now here in the coming weeks between now and when we air this program.
Yeah, so one of my other guiding principles as a journalist, I always say I never like talking about anyone unless I can talk to them. So I'm really trying to tie up loose ends here, you know, triple and quadruple reaching out to some people and organizations that haven't gotten back to me yet. Everyone that I've identified as someone who's either given or received funds, I want to talk to. So I'm still extending those invitations. I am still getting a sense of what comes next. You know, now that we know what we know, what's going to be done? If there's anyone identified who hasn't followed through on their promises, how will they? You know, and what are these citizens going to do? There are ideas that people have thrown out about, you know, how they can demand accountability. A couple of folks even mentioned there is, you know, they're going to reach out to some higher agencies of government to take some action. So it's really just now piecing this together and figuring out what moving forward from here looks like, both in terms of, you know, us putting together this show, but then also the entire community, what the city of Buffalo is going to do about what has been done or not been done for the east side of Buffalo and for the Black community, which is very intentional to say that because 514 was not something that happened to Buffalo. It happened to the Black community, you know, and it's not the Black community that made it that way. It's the shooter that made it that way. So that's another part of it, not to dig too deep, but in addition to the money, also just that sort of acknowledgement. A lot of people from the community tell me they feel is missing as well. So this project is really going to be us doing that.
I appreciate that. You couldn't have spoken any more eloquently about that last sentiment, and I appreciate you saying so.
Absolutely.
Ejaz Jassil, thank you so much for being with us. We're looking forward to more of your reporting on Where Did the Money Go?
Likewise. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate you.
This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.